Will it fit in here?
Yeah, I just don't know how to do it. Thank you, Pat.
Who knows how to put that thing in there?
There we go.
No, I don't want to hold it. Would you please?
You gotta hold it. Sorry.
Give me that thing. There we go.
I'm an alcoholic and my name is Pat. Can you hear me like this? Can you hear me pretty well? Are you going to do it for here, please? We had it backwards. Look at that. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's start all over. I am an alcoholic and my name is Pat. And I'm sober by the grace of God because this program does work one day at a time. And thank you for having me, and thanks to Greg for inviting me some time ago, even though he didn't show up. No. I know he's celebrating his mom's birthday. His mom's 94, I believe. And if I was him, I wouldn't miss that either. Because it made me think about, you know, about 2 years ago, my mom was 95, my dad was 99. I lost them both the same year. But 99 years and 94 years, I mean, really incredible. I'm really grateful for that. And they get to see me be sober. For the last, my birthday was last month. For the last 29 years, my mom and dad got to see me be sober. So I'm very grateful for that. So when I think about Greg and celebrating his mom's birthday, it reminds me of that. So, I better get this thing going. I got to keep track of time because I might get carried away. All right. Sober by the grace of God, because this program works one day at a time, I remembered something a long time ago that I had learned in a lot of meetings that I went to. I did hear this. I didn't hear a whole lot of other stuff, but I did hear this. And it was more important for me to remember what I am and not who I am if I forget what I am. It doesn't matter what my name is. My name doesn't matter. And like I think like a lot of us, I came in here with a really big ego, and I thought very highly of myself. Every meeting, my topic was me. When I was finished talking about me, I wanted you to talk about me, and so on. And I was just really selfish, self-centered guy. I mean, I really was. You know, I'm going to tell you kind of quickly. I grew up in a non-alcoholic family. Neither my mom nor my dad was alcoholic. My two older brothers, oldest, they were not alcoholic. The next brother, Tom, a year and a half older than me. He probably was. We didn't get to find out a period of time when he died. He died as a result of he smuggled a foreign substance from another country, and he died as a result of choking on his own vomit. He was about 30 years old. That was a long, long time ago, but I don't forget. But my sister, younger sister, not an alcoholic. As I grew up, I had a hard time going through the same schools that they all went to. They all went from the first grade to the eighth grade. They graduated. They went from 9th to 12th in the same school. They went to two schools. I was asked to leave that same school in the fifth grade. They kicked me out. I went to the next school. I made that one. I got kicked out of the next one. I went to high school. I got kicked out of that one, and so on. There's a lot of shame and guilt that comes along with that kind of stuff. You know, but I don't know it. I can't identify it. But the more I feel that way, probably the more that I act up. For whatever reason, I was just a troubled kid. Now, when I come here, I find out that, hey, maybe you're restless, irritable, discontent. But I don't know that yet. But I was in about seventh grade, and I found some guys, and they liked to drink alcohol, and they liked to smoke marijuana during school. And we became best friends. And that's when I started drinking and I started doing other things. And from that point on, I really drank and I used other things on a daily basis for a long, long time. There was consequences along the way. I began to lose certain jobs here and there. I did not graduate with my class. It took me an extra 6 months to graduate from the class. A lot of shame and guilt about that. My class graduated and I did not. And I made a joke out of it. I thought it was funny. I was like the class clown, because rather than look at these things, I would make a joke out of it. I would laugh and so on. So here's what happens. You know, I graduate from high school 6 months later, and I promptly commit a crime, and I promptly go to jail. I'm 18 years old. I've never been in jail. I've never been in a juvenile yet. Well, I passed that. Now I'm 18. But I've never been in jail yet, and I go to county jail. I spent a little bit of county jail, and while I'm in county jail, they told me that once you've been here, the chances are, the odds are very strong that you will probably be back. They had a percentage. They gave me a percentage, and I didn't want to let them down. I didn't want to break the percentage, so I committed a crime that I'm not proud of. I'm not going to tell you what it was. I'm not proud of it. I'm kind of ashamed of it, what I did, but what I did is what I did, and I went to jail for a period of time, and you know, there's always been people trying to help me my whole life. My mom and dad, when I was getting in trouble through school, they sent me to psychiatrists, to psychologists. I never said a word to them. I never told them how I felt, but there was opportunities for me to get help. I wouldn't take it. Even when I'm going to jail, my probation officer wanted to do something to help me. So what he did was, I went to jail for 60 days the second time, but I'm on probation. So while I'm in jail, he has an idea to get me into this program. I don't even know what it was called or what it was about. It wasn't attack therapy, but there was some kind of group stuff that went on, right? And the same thing, I would not share with them. I would be in the meetings and I'd be like this. And they told me I was very uptight. I go, no, I'm not. And but you know, things happen. God works in strange ways, man. While I was in jail, I could leave every day. And I could go up to a friend's house that I said I had a job, and I went to his place and I said I worked there. And all I did was go there and drink and smoke weed all day long. And then I'd come back at night. I came back one evening, and like every other evening, I went up on the roof. I'd been gone all day long. I go up on the roof to smoke some weed. I've been gone all day long. And there's a skylight on the roof, and I walked past it. My shadow went over it, and it's my probation officer's office down below it. And he came up there right after I took a hit of weed. And they sent me back to a county jail. They rolled me up. But they were going to give me an opportunity to come back. The group and everybody at the house had a decision whether I could come back or not. And what they did was they decided I was able to come back, but I had to go see the judge first. And I don't know if you've ever stood in front of a judge before. Some of us have. And they couldn't do this in open court because I'm in jail and I'm smoking weed while I'm in jail. And they took me into the judge's chambers. And I remember this clear as day because I didn't say a word to him. He talked to me. And he told me the things, and they gave me an extra 6 months. So I went into jail for 60 days, and I got out 9 months later. The guy that came in after me that got caught doing the same thing got another year. So actually, God took care of me in that respect, and it changed. I began to get really serious about the thing of where I was. And I want to say I never committed a crime since I left that place. I did commit one crime. It was a small thing. We stole a whole truck full of liquor. It was minor. I forgot to put it on my inventory. And then later on, I did call up my sponsor. I'm not the sharpest guy. You know, I always push the envelope. I always push the envelope. And at this time here, I'm a bar drinker. I drink in I used to call it my home bar. It's my bar. It's in Visitation Valley in San Francisco. If you know Visitation Valley, you know where it's at. It's not the nicest part of town. It's a bucket of blood bar. And I love this bar. I mean, I love this bar. And I would drink there all the time. If I went to go get something, I would go to the bar. I'd stop in the bar. When I got out of jail, through the grace of God, some people that were also helping me, I got a job and I worked in the shipyard. When I worked in the shipyard, I found the same kind of people that I drank with when I drank when I was in high school and so on and growing up. Same people, different names, different backgrounds, same kind of people. And I've learned here, somebody told me one time, water seeks its own level. And it's definitely true with me. And the whole time that I worked in the shipyard, now after a period of time, I had a thing called cleanliness control. I had a radiation control, and I had security clearance. I worked on aircraft carriers, and I worked around and on nuclear ships. I drank and I used every single day. I did not care anything about the true reality is I'm working on something that's the security of the nation. And I take it as a joke. And I drink and I use every day. And I drink and I use with the other guys every single day because I am an alcoholic. And I drink no matter what. And I know that today. So what happens is I go through life doing what I'm doing, bar drinking, going to work, going to the bar, going home, and just working and so on. And I have a wife at this time. I've been married now with my wife for, what year is this? 44 years. Yeah, I know. Man, 44 years. But we're very young at this time, and my wife has been with me. We could say she was a co or whatever during this time, but, you know, we had got along very well. We're together, and I wake up one morning after being laid off, and I've stayed home all day Friday just, detoxing from drinking the Thursday night because I got laid off. And I woke up Saturday morning, and I felt very sick. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. I felt like I had diarrhea. I'm just going to tell you what it was. I felt like I had diarrhea, and I ran. And I sat on a throne, and I thought, this is an awful lot of Hawaiian punch. I've been drinking Hawaiian punch all day long because I'm detoxing from the drink. I need fluids. And all of a sudden, I felt really, really sick, and I had to stand up, and I had to turn around and vomit. And it's more Hawaiian punch. It's not that much Hawaiian punch. That was Saturday morning. My solution to that was to smoke some marijuana. I had to go to a bachelor party Saturday night. I went to the bachelor party Saturday night. I didn't drink because my stomach, I'm very, very sick, but I snorted cocaine. I went to the hospital Sunday morning, and they took one look at me before I filled out any of the paperwork, and they just grabbed me, and they put me in emergency right away, and they had my wife fill out the paperwork. What happened was I had a bleeding ulcer that I don't know that I have. I'm used to having stomach aches because I drink all the time and I get drunk. I don't know what it is. I had a bleeding ulcer. It bled one time, it bled on its own, and it stopped. It was only 6 pints of blood. That was all I lost. And they told me that I'll have to take Tagamet and treat my stomach a certain way for the rest of my life. What I did from that point on is I quit drinking Crown Royal. Crown Royal was my drink of no choice. It's my drink of no choice. I drink it no matter what. And so what I'm doing now is I'm drinking vodka and orange juice for the health benefit because I have a stomach problem. So I start out very slow after that, but the progression of this disease is I'm going to start drinking and keep drinking the way that I did. I think that was in March of that year. I'm not positive. Towards the end of that year, I've been out again all night long. I've been with a guy down in Dog Patch, San Francisco, right off 3rd Street. Beautiful place, 3rd Street. And just a shed where this guy lives. And we're playing dominoes and we're doing a certain substance. And I don't even like him. I don't even like him. I know his name. I'm not going to say his name. Maybe because he might have got sober sometime. So. And I've been there all night long. I come home about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I come in very quietly. I don't want to wake up my wife. Somebody has to work, and she is, and I'm not. I'm probably laid off. But I sit on the couch, and I feel that pain. And I know what it is. It's a burning pain. It's right here on this side, on my left side. And I know the feeling. I know the pain. I know what it is. And I get up, and I go to the bathroom really quick. And God bless it, man. It didn't stop this time. I left the bathroom, I came on the couch, and I know that for some reason, I know that I have to call her, and she's down the hall, and I call her, and she comes out, and she screams, and she looks at me, and I'm as white as this chair, and I'm soaking wet in sweat, and there's blood running down my leg, my one leg, all the way down to the floor, made an imprint on the carpet where my foot was, and I go to San Francisco General Hospital. Okay, I'm watching the time here. I want to get through my drunkalogue. I want to show you how sick I was. I go in there, I'm in cardiac intensive care for 2 days. They come in every hour or two, and they ask me, and they talk to me about my drinking. In the other hospital, the first time, we didn't talk about my drinking. They're talking about my drinking now. And I told my wife, I go, for God's sakes, I go, I'm really, really sick. Please ask them not to come in here anymore. They're bothering me. And can I have some more of that morphine, please? I have surgery on my stomach. When I wake up, I have a row of staples all the way up here. I have a tube up my nose all the way down in my stomach. And I spend 6 days in San Francisco General before I'm well enough to be moved to Kaiser, where I have the coverage for all this. I spend 6 more days there, and they've never fed me. I've been fed intravenously the whole time. They want to see if my stomach is working. The day I leave, the doctor from UCSF comes and checks my stomach to see that it's working. And then he point blank told me, he says, if you drink again, he says, you will die. You will not make it back here. You'll bleed out. We won't be able to save your lousy ass. He didn't say that, but I said, are you sure? I'm kind of ashamed to say that. I mean, I'm really embarrassed to say that. Why couldn't I have said, what can I do? Can I do something? Can I go somewhere? How about those A&A people? That didn't even come to my mind. Never even thought about that. But I didn't ask any question. I didn't say anything about what I should do. I weighed in at 165 at that time. Now I've lost a lot of weight. I look like my dad. I noticed that today when I got dressed up. I go, you look just like your dad. I weighed 195, maybe I weigh in at 200 right now, maybe 200. I was 165. I stayed 165 for about the next two and a half years. I'm very sick. I'm a very sick man. I have been drinking since I was in junior high school on a daily basis. Good times I drink, bad times, no times, anytime I drink, and I do other things too along with it. Now, if you could picture this, the one thing's been removed. No more alcohol. You don't have it. I did try to drink one, maybe two times after that with very bad results, man. I was almost killed by the guys that I tried to rob. But I have a very serious problem. I have a very bad habit. I have a very bad habit. I am an alcoholic, and I drink to overcome a spiritual malady that I have. I am restless, irritable, discontent. I'm full of fear, shame, guilt, and remorse, and I take the drink, and that goes away just like that. But this other habit, I'm restless, irritable, discontent, full of fear, shame, guilt, and remorse, and I do it, and I'm twice as bad. It doesn't treat my spiritual malady, but I'm powerless over it, and I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. I go to my first treatment center in November of 1992. I've never been to a meeting before. I don't hold hands with other people. And I'm a wrist wrestler. You ever see the people that just come out of treatment center, the asylums, whatever, and they always want to wrist wrestle? I just go like this now. I just surrender here. Just hold my hand any way you want. But I would hold hands how I wanted. And I would say what I wanted to say, and I wanted to talk about what I wanted to talk about. I was given a whole bunch of big books when I got there. It was very, very expensive. I went to a place down in Santa Cruz. A lot of people have been down there. They gave me about 5 or 6 different books, and they said, tomorrow morning, bring your big book down to the meeting at 8 o'clock. We're going to have a meeting in the big book. And I looked at all of them. I go, I don't know which one's bigger than the other. I brought them all. I do not know anything about a big book. But I know this much. Because of me and my ego, I wouldn't hang out with the other clients or whatever that much. I don't know how to socialize. If we're not drinking, if we're not shaking dice, if we're not fighting, I don't know how to behave. But what I did was I read that book 2 times while I was in there to myself. I don't know how it's laid out. I don't know anything about the format of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't, but it did something to me. It stirred something up inside of me. I can tell you that. I didn't follow any directions. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get out and get a home group. I didn't do the steps right away, whatever. And that was in November of 92. From November of 92 until March of 94, I'm a newcomer. And I go to a lot of meetings. I'm in an SLE that's close by the Alano Club in Daly City, if you're familiar with that. I went to meetings, and the more meetings I went to, the worse I got. I'm spiritually sick, and I have no answer, no treatment, nothing that's satisfying to taking this, treating my malady at all. So I'm getting worse, and I don't know it. I went to 223 meetings in 90 days. And the 92nd day, I went to a meeting by myself down in the Tenderloin, down in the hotel room. I was the speaker. I was the secretary. I was everything. I suffered. I suffered needlessly. Needlessly, but I just couldn't let go. I went to a whole lot of meetings, and at one point, a friend of mine asked me, do I want to go down to San Francisco to Back to Basics meeting, kitty corner from the police department at the from the jail, the Police Officers Association building. And I heard about this meeting. I went down there. And across the table, sitting across from me, there was a guy. And I knew him. We used to drink and use together. But I haven't seen him in a couple years because he's here and I'm out there. And we greet each other really warmly. He asked me how I was doing. I told him I'm doing really well. He asked me what step I was on. I told him I am on step 7. I don't know why I said that either. I still don't. I thought I was. He asked me what they used to do a lot, these guys, this particular group. Pat, what's the problem? Why are you powerless over this? What is the problem? And basically, I just told him what I told you for the last about 16 or 17 minutes. That's what I told him. He said, I didn't ask you what you did when you drank. I asked you, why are you powerless? You don't know step one. I live in a city. He lives in Clayton. Right after that, sometime within a week or two, I began to go over his house. And we opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started to read it. I'm not going to tell you that him and I read it word for word, description by description, because he had certain parts of a lot of the pages or a lot of the chapters to really cover it. We went over it, I mean, pretty thoroughly. It's not the understanding I have of the book today by any means. But it was good enough for me to recognize that, one, I have a physical allergy to this thing here, no matter what. No matter if I'm happy, if I'm sad, no matter what's going on in life, I have a physical allergy to alcohol and other things too. It doesn't matter. Anything on the outside doesn't matter. I have this, and that's the bottom line. We went through the obsession pretty good. I got to tell you, the obsession is the one time in the book where it actually calls us the obsession, just like the phenomenon of craving. He calls, Dr. Young calls it the phenomenon also of the thinking. This thought is supplanted with another thought. I had to look that word up. It means it's taken place just like that. Now, for these 2 years that I've relapsed, it's very easy for me now to look at, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to do this. In a couple hours, I am. And my own mind lies to me. I have no control over my own thinking. It just runs on its own with no permission from me. I'll tell you that. And I began to see where this thing is an idea that overcomes every other idea, and it's more powerful than any mental defense I have. Any type of defense I've ever had, this has been the most powerful thing, besides what I'm going to find out later on in the steps. This is the most powerful thing at this time. And him and I went through this really well. The spiritual part, we went through. But I want to talk about that in a little bit, even more. But when I left his house, I had made a third step decision. Right after I did the third step decision, we did something that was very, very important to me, and I do with a lot of people. We did an asset and liability list. I'm from out there. He drew a line. He said, write your liabilities here, write your assets here. And I wrote down about 3 assets and about 25 liabilities. Because that was my perspective. That was how I saw me at that time. He came back into the room after I wrote, and he asked me a couple very simple questions. He asked me, how did you get here? And I thought, something's wrong with this guy, man. You know I drove over here. He said, you didn't put a car down. I didn't put his name down. I didn't put my wife's name down. I didn't put my mom and dad down. I didn't put my children down. So many things that I couldn't look at to see there were assets in my life. I was only able to look at the negative, and that's just where I was at that time. So I did this. He sent me home. He gave me the instructions. I went home, and you couldn't stop me if you tried for me to write my inventory, because I wanted to do this, and I'm moved. I think I'm more moved spiritually at this time than I even know it. I am, because on my own, I'm not going to write these things down. I wrote these things down, and of course, there's one thing that I didn't write down. I said, I don't need to tell him this. It's not important. I think I said to myself, I've got enough stuff here to make him happy. Well, that was how I thought at the time. And you know what? I got in his car, and as soon as I sat down, I told him the one thing that I swore I'd take to the grave. And he told me it wasn't so bad. He's done something similar. It wasn't that bad. that did a great deal for me because I don't have any secrets anymore. I don't have resentments anymore. And to tell you the truth, I never had a secret in the first place, and I never had a resentment either. They had me. They had me. They controlled my life. They controlled my emotions, my decisions, and everything I did. You know, I went through most of the rest of the book with this guy, and as I did the steps, and after my fifth step, and I got to a place, and I'm pretty sure I'm making amends, and, you know, I made a mistake with amends. I went to my mom and dad, and I made an amends for certain things that, you know, that this son did to them and whatever, and I was really, really happy about it. And basically, I went to them, and I didn't say I was sorry because there's no admission of any responsibility, of any guilt or whatever, you know. But I made amends for my behavior with them, all this, you know, all my drinking and using. And I called him up, and I was so happy, man. I was so happy. He said, how's the payment plan you worked out with them for all that money that you lied, cheated, borrowed, and stole from them? He said, well, when you go back and do it right this time, we'll set that up. And I did. And I did that. And I did that with many other amends that I had to take because, you know, I used to put empty envelopes in the ATM and get money. You could do that a while ago. Don't try it. Don't work. It doesn't work. And I wrote checks on accounts I didn't have. I owed a lot of money here. And I really dreaded the fact of how much money I owed, and I'll never be able to repay it. And then when I went to the meetings, I heard about these promises, and I thought, you know, I think they mean that I'm going to hit the lottery. And that's not what they meant. And financial fear went away when I faced my creditors. Because I would never answer the phone. I would never look at the letters that had some kind of red stuff on them, whatever. I owed a lot of money. I really did. And, you know, I think of it this way is I have a pile of rocks over here. I've got, like, let's say 1,000 rocks. I can't move them. I can't move them all at once. But each day I go by, I get one rock. I take it with me. I throw one over here. I take one. I throw one over there. And after a couple months, I look, and the pile's getting smaller and smaller. And that's what I did. With the IRS, I had to make a payment plan with the state and the federal, my mom and dad and everybody else I did. And I began to get free. But I got to tell you, man, I've gone through all the steps, and I've done it, you know, more than once. And the thing that I think I want to talk about the most is the gift that I've been given in helping another alcoholic. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, I have a couple friends here in the front row, and I have a couple friends back here. Every single one of them has heard me a whole lot of times speak. I don't know why they keep coming. I think they have bad memories. But to have a host of friends is an experience you must not miss. A step 12 promise. I have a lot of friends. I moved over here to Brentwood, is where I live now. I moved during COVID, so the first 24 years of my sobriety was in San Francisco. And during COVID, my wife and I, we kind of looked around at the house, whoever. My one daughter lived in I have three daughters. One daughter lived in Brentwood. She has a brand new baby, first grandchild. And, well, thank God we moved, because my wife would have driven back and forth every single day. And we moved over, and I'll tell you, it's like the beginning of a new life for me. And I've always heard a lot of people say when they moved, they went to AA, they don't do it right, or they didn't feel they didn't feel they fit in, and so on and so forth. I got to tell you, man, AA was doing very well without me when I got there. Very well. They didn't need me to improve or change anything. And I felt like after a couple of months that I've lived here for years. But I really do. I got busy right away doing the same thing I did all the years in there. I sponsored people. And I got to tell you, one of the saving graces that's been in my life the whole time has been the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not the smartest guy in town, but I learned from a lot of other people to take the book and explain it into English. And when you see someone's eyes light up and they say, when are we going to meet again? When are we going to read again? What are we going to do? Whatever. That's just gold to me. Till this very day, that is still gold to me. There's times when I'm reading that book with somebody else that I kind of get up and I start walking around. I feel like I'm a carnival preacher. My spirit moves so much when I do this, it's unexplainable. It's unexplainable why a guy like me that came from where I came from, did, you know, the things that I did, has been taken care of the way that I've been taken care of. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is mind-blowing to me. You know, like, I think it's important where I'm at today. I have three daughters. One daughter lives in Brentwood. Now another daughter, my oldest daughter, she moved to Brentwood also. And the other twin, there's twins, lives in Fremont. So I have the one grandson, Johnny. He's a beautiful boy. He's 5 years old. He reminds me of that little guy right there a lot. Reminds me a lot. And Johnny, God, it's like a new phase of life to have the grandson, to get the benefit and to appreciate and enjoy all that, right? Just incredible. And he's so good. It's great when he goes home, but I love the kid, man. I mean, I love him. And that's my daughter, Allie. And then Allie announced that she was pregnant. She's having another baby in June. So Joey's a year old. So I get to see them every day, all the time. If I'm not sober, if I'm not doing this, am I going to see this? And then Amanda, the oldest, who also moved to Brentwood, she's been trying for quite some time, and I don't think she's going to be able to have one. But, oh, no, Amanda's pregnant. And then the sister, the twin in Fremont, Erin. Oh, no, jeez. Erin comes over one day. She goes, guess what? All three of them. The babies are all 1 year old. 1 year, Joey's 1 year, 2 or 3 months. Mario's a year and a couple less months. And Roman turned a year last week. I don't know anything that's better in my life besides Alcoholics Anonymous. And the gift that I get to see to be with these kids here, you know. So I got to tell you, it was so important for me to go through with someone else and to save them. It's a little bit hot up here. To save the other alcoholics that I work with, the troubles that I went through because I didn't understand things. That I thought that I admitted that I was powerless. I said that I'm powerless over alcohol, but I did not believe it. In my heart, I would say it, but I don't believe it. And it wasn't until I was really convinced that I really had this disease. But the thing that I was missing, the part that I didn't know, was the spiritual part of this thing that I had, that I only knew when I did my steps the first time. I said, I got all the chips on the table. I did all the work. And I said, you have a spiritual problem. But that was as far as I went. I never looked any deeper. I never went to the exact nature of the wrong. Why do you feel this way? Well, maybe it's shame and guilt. Maybe, of course, because I'm restless, irritable, discontent, I take the drink, that goes away, but now I don't have the drink. And we agnostics, you know, it says, very clearly to me, it says, you must find a spiritual basis of life or else. I already know what or else is, and I don't want that anymore. So I began to really focus and be aware on the spiritual part of this program, and I struggled with step two for quite a while. I'm Irish Catholic. Any Irish Catholics in here? We go to church. I got family over. My brother's in Ireland right now, and him and his wife's family, they go to church every single day. And if you're not at Mass in the daytime, they're going to ask, I didn't see you at Mass today. Oh, jeez, okay. I used to admit and say that I believed and said God, but it wasn't there. It wasn't there. And really important, it says we came to believe. So I may not believe right now, but I'm going to arrive and I'm going to get to that point. And as a result of doing the work and as the result of results, I have a faith today because it's carried me through and got me through so many things that before I never could get through before. That I drank over every single time. And that's not the case anymore. I have a faith and I have a dependence upon that. And, you know, the support that I have from other people, because I'm a thief and I learn and I steal from things that you guys say because I'm able to use it. And my friend Jim here, he knows that today, one of the most important things that I have today is I had to have a first step experience. For me, is to drink, is to die. There's no option. I have no other thing. I can't not drink on my own. I had that thing. I used to say there's no choice. The book says there's no choice. The drugs, I had a very, very hard time with that for a little while until I realized that I am powerless over it. A very bad habit. But what treats my spiritual malady? It was the booze. Today, what treats my spiritual malady is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the grace of God, and the support that I have from so many people. I'll tell you, I came here a broken man with nothing. I lived in an SLE for 2 years. My wife had left me and took the three girls, and she moved out on her own. And I thought it was over. She started a divorce proceeding. She didn't follow through the grace of God. And we end up talking again and getting back together again. And we've been together for the last 29 or 30 years of our lives together. And I've been able to raise those children. I thought I was going to have boys. I was supposed to have all boys. You know what I mean? And God gave me three girls. Then the three girls gave me all boys. So who's in charge? Well, it's not me. But I got to tell you, I think I'm kind of running out of time, and I'm not going to try to just keep going for seven more minutes, just to go for seven more minutes. I got to tell you, if you're new and you haven't done this thing or whatever, find someone to take you through this program. To find someone to take you through these steps very thoroughly so that you too can have a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, and have a much better life than anything I ever could have imagined. My life today, I've been retired for 15 years, and it's because I've had 8 surgeries on my right knee, but I don't even care about that anymore. I am a satisfied customer. This program has done more for me than I ever could have imagined that I would have the life that I have today. So with that, I want to say thank you all very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.